is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, yet again, we arrive here in this dark disquiet known as the Mohorovicic Continuity, and you've locked in to the one and only Grillion Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with Caleb Hanks, here in the bunker with us. Good evening, Caleb. How are you?
I'm great, Micah. How are you doing?
Well, you look like you're not fatigued and you're ready to go for an entire evening of radio broadcast. And I'm excited about tonight's broadcast because joining us in studio, we have a very special guest sitting in with us as one of the boys in the bunker, Mr. Jeremy London. Good evening, sir, and how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, doing great. Good to have you in here. This guy right here, we've been friends with Jeremy for years. And I think only tonight I'm finding out, like, how into, like, UFOs and weird stuff you are.
They're FOs.
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 Yes, yeah, flying objects. We don't know. They could be identified flying objects. You know, a few of them, I think, remain unidentified, and we're going to see a little bit about that later in the program. As we discuss one commentator's very interesting discussion about UFO phenomena, and specifically Project Blue Book. We even get into a little bit of Roswell talk about this. I couldn't believe who it was talking about it. You may not either. And it was a bit warming to my heart. That'll be during hour two. During hour one, though, it's good that we're talking about this, guys, because, you know, Caleb, I was talking with Phyllis Galdi of Fate Magazine just the other day. And she was telling me that there's going to be a feature in the upcoming edition about Fate Magazine that has to do with animal communication. Now, she also publishes the Species Link Journal. I don't know where a lot of people out there stand on animal communication or their ability to do it. Do you believe, Caleb, that animals can communicate with one another?
Potentially, yes. I think so.
What about with humans, though?
You know, I think they'd have to be able to. It reminds me of the potato dwarf in Doctor Who. He's not your common tater.
He's not a tater at all, really. He just kind of looks like one. What if some animals aren't really animals at all? They're just people that look kind of like animals. I thought I was sitting there talking to my dog all night, and it turns out it was my neighbor sitting in the room with me.
When the cat vomits up a hairball and stands there and screams at me afterwards, she's trying to tell me something.
She's trying to communicate. Is she consciously literally saying, I am choosing to communicate? But then again, you know, if I yell at somebody standing out on the street after I've just, you know, vomited everywhere, usually I'm not cognizant of the fact that I'm communicating either.
I'm just trying to find my bottle of cheap hooch.
To our special guest in the studio, Jeremy, do you ever feel that you've had an animal try to communicate with you?
Every time my dog has to poop.
Ah, yes. He's very clear in stating.
He's very clear.
He knows exactly what he's trying to do. Well, I've got this story here. Doesn't have so much to do with animal communication like what we're going to see in Fate Magazine in this upcoming issue, but it certainly does have to do with wonders of the natural world, because it seems like all the time we're discovering things about animals that we don't, well, or rather that we never observed and we didn't know that they could do, but it totally changes the way that we think about these animals. Bats, for instance, they're known for being, well, you've heard the expression blind as a bat. In fact, they may not really be blind at all. They may, in fact, use patterns of polarized light to help them navigate. Now, Richard Holland and Stephen Grief of Queen's University Belfast, poor guy, I can't say that name, Grief, without, you know, lamenting just a little bit, especially lamenting the fact that he has a name like Grief. Oh, good grief, you did great, good job. What are you happy or are you sad? I'm not sure. You said good. Oh, okay.
Everyone hates me.
Well, he and his pal Richard Holland and a few other researchers showed that apparently female greater mouse-eared bats use the way that the sun's light is scattered in the atmosphere at sunset to calibrate their internal magnetic compasses. Now, a study which is the first to show this ability in a mammal is published in Nature Communications. Now, when sunlight which radiates in all directions is scattered by the Earth's atmosphere, it becomes directional. Polarization patterns depend on where the sun is in the sky. They're most evident at sunrise and sunset in a strip across the sky 90 degrees from the position of the sun. And so, essentially, by simulating this in the laboratory, it was determined that bats actually utilize this, much like birds do, in order to orient themselves magnetically at sunset. Now, hypothetically, they could actually do this at sunrise just as well, but bats typically aren't, you know, waking up and flying around at sunrise. You know, hence the connection, of course, with bats and, well, vampires. You know, they come out and they fly by night in the most literal sense, feast on bugs all evening, and go to bed before the sun rises. Now, we'd already demonstrated that bats used a magnetic compass that was calibrated by cues observed at sunset. The question, according to Holland, was, what cues? It was almost that, or rather it was known that birds can calibrate the magnetic field with the pattern of the polarization at sunset already, and so we tried the same for bats, and essentially they are able to do that. Which is interesting because we've got, of course, you know, avian species, and then we've got a little mammal here, a little rat with wings, who's able to do the same thing. And when we make these kind of comparisons between different varieties of animals, there are from time to time surprising things that come to our attention. Now, Jeremy, before the show, you were telling me about this study between humans. Was it object permanence that they were talking about?
Object permanence,
what,
yes.
What was the essence of this that was going on?
Really what the documentary was about was they took a three-month-old chimpanzee and a three-month-old human baby.
Uh-huh.
They showed the chimpanzee a treat, put it in a box, put a lid on it, showed the human baby a set of keys, put them in the box, put the lid on it. The monkey understood immediately that the object that they showed him was permanent. So he took the lid off, picked up the treat, ate the treat. The baby, once the keys were in the box with the lid on it, it was a mystery.
It was a mystery. The baby didn't understand.
The baby didn't understand. It just disappeared. That's why peekaboo works.
Huh. That's interesting, though. But, I mean, yet again, so the baby chimpanzee, though, what would we infer from this, I guess?
Something about their frontal lobes develop faster than human children for some reason.
That's interesting. You know, and yet again, it doesn't necessarily show superiority of the chimpanzee at that age, a literal rise of the Planet of the Apes here, you know, to you know, evoke a popular meme of today. But what it does show is that, you know, there are surprising things that we see in nature that, you know, animals are capable of doing. I mean, you might compare that in a way with, like, you know, for instance, you know, a baby, you know, calf or something, you know, bovine species. They're born, and virtually the moment that they are born, they're able to get up and walk around, whereas a baby, you know, there are stages that human babies take, and maybe it's such the case that human brain development also takes a little longer relative to certain other animal species, but that the end result is through a prolonged series of developmental stages, ultimately there is a greater cognitive ability that results.
I think we've evolved that way. I think with the invention of, you know, tools and any sort of even basic technology has kind of, you know, altered our chemistry.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the way that not only that we interrelate to the environment, but literally the way that our bodies and our brains develop over time, you know, person for person. It's fascinating to think about all this. But, you know, again, we look at the natural world, we think we've got all the answers, and then we find, you know, simple things, you know, how a bat orients itself, you know, at night with the, you know, with magnetism. You know, and it's so simple as being...
Female bat.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. Yeah, they say in the study that it was female bats. I wonder, again, the question might be, could it be any different if it's a female bat or if it's a male bat? You know, because sometimes between different species, you know, there are vastly different operational modalities that occur. Come on, ask any guy, ask any girl. They're going to tell you the same thing. Oh, men are from Mars and, you know, women are from Venus. Is that right? I think that's the phrase. But,
yeah.
But anyway, I digress. I mean, it's interesting stuff. Almost as interesting as the mysteries around us. You already said the M word tonight, Jeremy. Last week on the podcast, Tyler and I tried to break apart the way that in the media, I think that there's a bit of overuse of the term mystery. And so today, and if you go to graylingreport.com, you'll actually see in the news roundup that we've got, the first four stories are all mysteries. We're going to examine those when we come back from this break. But I ask you, dear listener, how many of these are actually mysterious? Now, I think at least one of them really is, maybe two of them. The other two, I think it's basically somebody fishing for hits on their website. We'll examine these mysteries. One of them really actually has me scratching my head when we come back here on the Gray Alien Report. Stay with us. From the high mountains of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report, the one and only. Keeping you company every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. A quick thank you to all of our wonderful people out there in the chat room who help us know how we sound. I think we're sounding pretty good tonight, in fact. Or now we are. Podcast listeners, of course, always have the benefit of never hearing little hiccups. It's interesting to me because I am so fascinated with this whole mysterious thing. Everything that we hear about, everything that we see these days, mysterious. Just to give you an idea of a few things that are trending in the news today. Beaufort man sustains mysterious gunshot wound. Deputies responded to a report of shots fired in the Grays Hill Acres area at 8:47 p.m., but no one on the scene would speak to them. Now, this is a little weird, but here's basically what's being said. There was a man with an apparent gunshot wound. He was walking down a road. According to the Beaufort County Sheriff's Office, the man was wearing only underwear and had an apparent gunshot wound. And get this, he wouldn't talk about what had happened to him. They said that the injuries were non-life-threatening, but according to Sergeant Robin McIntosh, the guy he refused to speak to law enforcement. I don't know if that's all that mysterious. I don't know. The guy had a gunshot wound. What in the world could be going on with that? So let's see if this one's any more mysterious. We've also got this. An anonymous person who goes by the name Tips for Jesus has left giant gratuities at bar. Have you guys heard about this by chance? Tips for Jesus.
No, not at all.
Now get this. The receipts are posted to Instagram. On Saturday, July 19th, it appears that Tips for Jesus was in New Orleans and left a $10,000 tip on a $9,000 tab. Wow, a $10,000 tip. That is incredible. Now, there's speculation that the generous tipper is former PayPal Vice President Jack Shelby. San Francisco Magazine claims to have interviewed Tips for Jesus, although the publication wouldn't reveal the mysterious man's identity. There's that word, mysterious. I guess it's a little mysterious. You know, I mean, here's a dude who leaves a $10,000 tip. I mean, I think that's more, like, awesome than anything.
Is he really mysterious, though? Was he wearing a mask?
Was he wearing, like, a cape?
A hood?
Yeah, this guy. Now, apparently, Galatorides, which is the restaurant, has neither confirmed nor denied whether the visit was knowingly by the Tips for Jesus. But apparently, I guess what this is it's like a page, and they put the images up on Tips for Jesus. Galatorides Restaurant, indulge in the tradition, it says, and here we've got this receipt, and you'll see the subtotal. Boy, I'd like to know who was spending $9,094.98 on dinner at Galatorides. That's at 209 Bourbon Street, New Orleans, by the way, if you've ever been there. Must be really, really high class. I'd like to see if anybody else has been there. But sure enough, Shelley was the server. Shelley L., I'm looking at this a picture of this tip right now. If I were Shelley L., boy, I'd be extremely excited. Because, first of all, dinner was $9,000, and the gratuity, $10,000.
Do you think he put the comma in the wrong place?
No, because I mean, there's like 10 and then three zeros, and it's underlined. This is incredible. And then next to the total, he writes, boom, $19,094.98, as in 19094.98. Oh, my God. He made somebody's night. And she thus probably quit her job and, you know, went on a holiday. Man, oh, that is truly remarkable. I have to say that's incredible. Now, that was mysterious, I guess.
Mysterious.
You know, it was mysterious in that apparently no one was seemingly forthcoming with the mystery and who was presumably behind the actual tip. Now, this one might be a little bit more mysterious. Poor Caleb, look, he's having to run around and fix stuff. That's why we have engineering staff in the bunker. Now, this is a little bit more mysterious. In East Aurora, we're not talking about Aurora, Illinois. We're not talking about Aurora, Texas, but East Aurora, New York. There have been some strange road signs popping up all around the place. Nobody seems to know where they're coming from. The signs apparently depict UFOs and cows being abducted by the UFOs. Now, Mayor Alan Kasparak has his suspicions of who might be responsible. He doesn't think it was the work of aliens. He says, I believe it might be the East Aurora Food Cooperative that's trying to get off the ground. That's my hunch, but I'm not entirely positive. I would like to know what in the world might be going on up there, because there is an interesting tie-in with UFOs and places titled Aurora.
Mystery signs are popping up in East Aurora. No one seems to know where these strange symbols came from. They appear to have a UFO theme to them. Are they a hoax, or do they have some sort of meaning?
Well, we sent News 4's Emily Gugemas to check them out tonight. Emily, what'd you find?
People have been spotting the signs since the beginning of the summer, but no one has caught whoever's hanging them, leaving chattering residents curious to find out who's behind them. East Aurora is known for a number of things. The Roycroft, Fisher-Price, and aliens?
I don't know whose idea it is, or maybe the aliens put them up. Who knows?
Signs like these are popping up in the village, including this one in front of Bill Bernhardi's home on Gypsy Lane.
Well, I was looking out for crop circles. I was, you know, just checking to make sure the gravitational field around here is the same as it is everywhere else, but...
Okay, let me just go ahead and just stop it right there. You know, mystery. Okay, the signs, I don't know that they're actually that mysterious at all. Yet again, we've got... It's like I feel almost like I'm wasting my time even talking about this. I'm looking at this. Okay. They are UFOs, flying saucers. There are cows being beamed up. More importantly, I'm seeing this story, though. Mysterious UFO street signs appearing in East Aurora. When I first saw this, I thought, okay, well, maybe it's like a connection with the whole UFO Aurora thing. People in UFO circles will know exactly what I'm talking about. But this is, again, it's East Aurora, New York. And yes, again, you know, the mayor suspects that there may be something going on, not with aliens, but rather having to do with a food co-op. Interesting. So I look at a story like this, WIVB.com carrying it, News 4 out of East Aurora, and I'm thinking, I wonder, is this just like a plug? If they knew that it was probably something having to do with the co-op, not so much a news story as it is like a plug for like what they're doing, you know? It's like viral stuff that you see on the web. You hear about like videos going viral. Well, now people are basically trying to like take viral to real life, and they start putting clues rather than on websites and stuff. They put signs up all over town, you know, advertising something. It's still going to end up on the web no matter how you look at it. And then it's a mystery. It's a mystery. Something truly mysterious. But there was one mystery story that really did catch my eye today. This one, I was sitting at the beer garden downtown in Asheville today, and we'd stopped in for lunch, and Mr. McNonymous of Middle Theory fame and I came across this story. It was truly bizarre. And it literally took place up there in McNonymous, well, close to his hometown. He didn't live in Brooklyn, but he's in New York. This morning, apparently New York City police found something. Well, actually, it was, I believe, construction workers that discovered it, and the police were trying to figure out who was behind it. Two white flags raised over the Brooklyn Bridge. These things are very large. It's extremely difficult, or presumably would be, for someone to get up there. And yet, these two white flags were flying. It is believed this is some sort of political message, but nobody's certain exactly what happened. Now, John Miller, the city's deputy commissioner for intelligence and counterterrorism, said that at an afternoon press conference, that the lights illuminating the flags were seen to flicker at around 3 a.m., just before the switch was made on security cameras. What apparently happened was that security camera videos actually show people scaling the bridge, climbing up into place, and they probably used some sort of like containers or something to place over the tops of the lights. The flickering seen on the security cam was the lights momentarily being blocked off, and then the people who climbed to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge carried out whatever they did, which was switching the flags in complete darkness. It's believed that the perpetrators had a background in climbing training, but it's unclear right now what the motive of this was. But here's what is known. Okay. Now, Miller said that the security video shows that four or five people in a group and some other individuals, doesn't name how many, but apparently there were more on the ground, and then about four or five actually climb up right after 3 a.m. At around 3:30, the light that normally illuminated the flag flickered and then appeared to go out, and then it comes back on a few minutes later. During the 13-minute gap, the two flags go up, and it says it looked like it had been thought out in advance. Well, I mean, yeah. I don't think this is a bunch of guys sitting around, you know, hey. You know
what I want to do tonight?
Yeah.
I want to put some white flags on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah, let's just see if anybody notices.
Let's put our craft beer down and then go do this.
You just get me, man.
Now, the NYPD commissioner, William Bratton, said he's not particularly happy about the event. Well, no kidding. This one of the mystery stories we've looked at here, I don't think that this one is somebody trying to launch a viral video. I'm looking at, you know...
It's Macklemore.
Yeah.
He did the same thing on the Space Needle a couple months back.
You know, I'm looking at the mystery gunshot wound. I mean, you know, again, I think what this was there was an altercation and somebody didn't want to have to talk about what actually happened. They didn't want to implicate somebody else in a possible, well, I mean, obvious crime. Somebody shot him. A little weird that the guy was walking down the street wearing just his boxer shorts. You know, the $10,000 tip, again, not really mysterious so much as it is awesome. And the whole point here is that, as we illuminated last week, you know, all you have to do is write mysterious on something. Try it at home.
Did you just say you illuminated?
Well, we'll talk about the Illuminati a little later. No, all you have to do in order to draw attention to what you're trying to promote online is write the, oh, mysterious, or ancient secret revealed. I mean, there are other ones that you see, too. One weird trick.
Or man steps on banana peel and you'll never guess what happens
you
next.
You won't believe what this man found in his backyard. I'd like to see the dog that left that. But then this Brooklyn Bridge story, I mean, this is almost like the kind of thing you'd see in, like, a superhero movie. It opens with some sort of a weird symbolic message that is left. And furthermore, now, I mentioned that there were white flags raised. But what these actually appear to be are American flags that were bleached white. You can actually see the remnants of the stars and the stripes on the flags in images that I believe Gothamist.com had carried earlier today. I'd been listening to talk radio on my way to Greenville because McNonymous flew out of New York just this morning. And I asked him when he arrived, I said, you know, well, I'm sorry, I didn't know about it at that time. We made it all the way back from Greenville and got to Asheville. And I asked him, I said, did you see anything about this? Did you notice anything weird in New York this morning? Well, it's New York. You notice something weird every day in New York.
Yeah.
But he says, you know, there was nothing out of the ordinary. No, but I wasn't in Brooklyn either. He apparently went to Newark, New Jersey, and flew out of that airport. And I'm thinking, why did I not hear this on the news? I had the news on for a good hour and a half before I picked him up from the airport, and I hadn't heard anything, and I picked him up right at about 11. Well, apparently the news sites weren't carrying this until about noon. It was around noon that Gothamist posts the pictures. This is really strange. And I'm looking at this initially, and I'm thinking, well, first of all, the American flags were replaced with white flags, or did somebody in the middle of the night manage to actually discolor the flags, i.e. using paint, or do something else that bleached the flags? No, it seems that bleached flags were carried up and that they were what were used to replace the existing flags. And this is, of course, the big thing that's got everybody hot about this. The white flag, of course, is apparently the international symbol for surrender. And so Miller had said in this report that whether the decision to use bleached American flags was a statement of patriotism or defiance was up to everybody's interpretation. Nobody seems to know, but apparently bleached white flags as though to communicate an act of surrender. What is that supposed to mean? It could mean any number of things with all the stuff going on internationally. One actually hits the mark. I would say that story right there actually qualifies for being mysterious. I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think? Mysterious?
No, not at all.
You don't think so?
No.
You think it was some jokers, huh?
Yeah. I think people went up there.
People just looking for something to do?
Yeah, people climb that bridge all the time. When I lived there, you would hear about it all the time, people climbing that bridge.
Huh. You know, I don't know. I mean, if I had time to kill, I might involve myself in something. Well, I don't know. I mean, again, if there's a political message behind it, I could see why somebody might do that. It may not be anything nefarious. It's certainly not legal. But the question is, again, what's the meaning of this? I don't know. That is a little mysterious to me. When we come back, we'll continue to probe the mysteries of space and time. Maybe we'll get to some actual space-time mysteries here on the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Stay with us. It seems everywhere we look these days, we're hearing something new about drones. In fact, my local television news station contacted me recently, and they wanted to interview me about it. Literally, it seems like everybody is seeing drones. Now, some of these are operated by military, others may be by weekend hobbyists who enjoy flying remote-controlled planes. But what if I told you not all of these drones are so easily identified? What if I told you that there were strange aircraft out there that are too small to be piloted? But many of them don't even have wings. They behave more like missiles or torpedoes. And nobody seems to know where they come from.
If you're like me and you'd like to know more about what may be flying around out there in our skies that we don't know about, you need to take a look at my book, The Ghost Rockets. In it, you'll find incredible reports from some of the most credible sources, including trained pilots and aviation professionals, as well as databases maintained by NASA. UFO doesn't have to mean a spaceship from another world. In fact, I think what may be going on right here on planet Earth could be a lot stranger. If you want the inside scoop on drones, missiles, and phantom projectiles in our skies, then don't wait. Get a copy today of The Ghost Rockets, available on Amazon.com and at GraylianReport.com. These aren't the drones you hear about every day on the news, and what you'll learn may change your mind about UFOs. The Ghost Rockets, available in paperback and on Amazon Kindle.
Thanks. Welcome back to the Graylian Report. Picking apart what we see in the media, how much is truly mysterious? Now, I'll tell you what. UFOs, to me, are mysterious. We're going to be talking about that a good bit in the next hour. In fact, we're going to delve into one of my favorite all-time UFO reports. One from South America, and one that really blows my mind, makes you think about what might actually be going on out there. But before we get into that, I think it's a nice transition, because we're going to really kind of, at the top of the next hour, kind of kick things off first by talking about the way that conspiracy theories, I think, cause people to misinterpret things like UFO phenomena, at least in terms of just having open, honest discussions about them. And so as a prelude to the discussion about strange conspiracy theories and things like that, and then actual strange phenomena, as we know with regard to Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, there are a lot of conspiracy theories flying around out there right now, no pun intended. You know, I try not to be too punny when it comes to discussing this story. But Caleb and I did talk about it last night. And one thing that Caleb brought to my attention, well, we had discussed it. I had thought about it, too. But he came over and talked about it with me, as you know, and I think this is on a lot of people's minds. You know, there were more than 100 of the world's best AIDS researchers who were on board MH17. And so, again, this is something that kind of fuels a lot of conspiratorial thought. A lot of people are kind of looking at this going, damn, you know, was there some reason that plane was taken down? It's interesting. Now, of the conspiracy theories, there was a roundup that The Guardian put up on their website just today, which they consider alternative explanations for what, now I don't think they actually endorse these, keep in mind, but these are some of the alternative explanations that people are putting out. Now, among these are that the Ukrainians did it, that the Ukrainian army should be the best equipped force in Ukraine. They write it definitely has Buks, which Russia says it deployed near the separatist militia areas in advance of the attack. It shot down MH17 because, well, that's where this theory falls down. They say there's no reason why Ukraine, which already has significant sympathy from the international community, would jeopardize its position by senselessly attacking a civilian flight and hoping the blame would be stuck to Russia. But there are people who are saying it. So, well, then there are other people who are saying, okay, maybe it was the Ukrainians attempting to shoot down Vladimir Putin. Putin, in fact, and Russian news sources had actually even been saying that they thought that the Ukrainians shot down the jet because the Ukrainians thought that it was actually Putin's jet. Now, what's interesting about this is that Putin had apparently already ordered that, you know, there was going to be a no-fly zone. He and his, and specifically his aircraft, were not going to be flying anywhere in that area. But apparently, Russia's Interfax agency had reported excitedly after the attack that the presidential jet had been flying roughly the same trajectory, even though it was known since March, I believe, that that plane would not have been in that airspace. What's more, the planes bore strikingly similar markings, the red and blue horizontal stripes on a white fuselage, and hence the Russian media had been saying it was very obvious that there could have been a mix-up. Now, The Guardian writes that it was not only unlikely, it seems that, of course, well, as I've already pointed out, the paths that the planes did briefly cross were apparently near Warsaw, but, of course, we probably know that Putin would not have been in that area in the first place anyhow. But that leads us, of course, to the idea that there was some sort of effort to try and conceal the truth about HIV and AIDS. I don't really think that again, and Caleb, I think you'd ask this too, if it had been solely for the purpose of taking down the plane and killing more than 100 of the world's best HIV/AIDS researchers, well, whoever was launching the attack, how would they know that that plane, in theory, they might have been able to do it. I know that we, of course, heard a lot about Flight Radar 24, the website, which is an incredibly comprehensive website, and I've got the app on my phone. It had been used to actually track what had been happening in the moments, or the minutes at least, before the plane actually did go down. So, hypothetically, if someone had known that there was going to be a flight of AIDS researchers who were headed to a summit in Australia, maybe they could have, you know, found the flight. But the thing is, and this is maybe one of the greater mysteries about this, is that I don't think that in likelihood they would have anticipated the plane being in that airspace, because civilian aircraft had already been advised not to fly through that area, much like Putin had chosen not to do. There shouldn't have been civilian aircraft, commercial airliners especially, flying near the border at that time, and yet, of course, this aircraft was. Now, The Guardian writes, early reports of the disaster suggested over 100 people working in the field of HIV and AIDS research en route to a major international conference in Melbourne had perished. But now get this, they say when a clearer picture emerged, this was actually revised, they say, down to 7. Now that's interesting. I guess what they're inferring is that rather than there being 100 people who were experts, because I do think that there were more than 7 people who were headed to Australia, okay, who were involved in this crash, but what they're saying is that there were actually only 7 people, purportedly, who were directly involved in the actual research. I know one of them, I think, had been a Bostonian, and I think... In fact, I think that one of the local news agencies in Boston had reported on this individual, but yet again, there was supposed to have been only one American initially thought to have been on this flight. No less horrific for those who perished or their friends and family, but perhaps less grist to the mill of those who speculated that the plane had been shot down to prevent a cure for AIDS being revealed. Apparently, the global elite, says The Guardian, is keen to stop us learning about the cure for AIDS, and it wants to depopulate the Earth. It seems fair to say that the global elite is not doing a very good job at this. Gosh, you know, again, I think it's probably unlikely too, but it is certainly tragic. And of course, one of the big issues about this that everyone's read about over the last few days is the fact that, of course, the research community that does look into trying to cure the AIDS virus, well, they've felt like this was a significant blow. And yes, that the researchers who died, whether it be 7 or maybe, you know, hundreds, or at least nearing 100. I think that there were a lot of people who were en route to Australia to attend this summit. However few, it was considered a big hit. And then, of course, there's the theory that it was Israel. It could have been Israel. Now, you know, Jeremy, you went to Israel just how long ago was it?
Last August.
Last August.
Yeah.
Okay, we were just talking about this before the show. And so this is what they write. They say, speaking of global elites, if one delves far enough, I guess they're trying to tie in the whole idea of there being, you know, the whole Israel lobby and everything here, hence global elites. That's why they're talking about it here. They say, one will quickly find talk of globalists, internationalists, banksters, and Zionists. Now, the coincidence of the MH17 shooting with the latest outbreak of conflict in Israel and Palestine has provided perfect explanations for many who see the puppet master Zionist running everything. Keep in mind, folks, this article is being tongue-in-cheek, you know, or kind of delving in and out of tongue-in-cheekness. So I don't want someone to hear these tongue-in-cheek expressions being made here and think that they're being serious. They're obviously not. Curiously, they never say Jews run the world anymore. It's always couched in euphemism. Perhaps this is progress of a sort, but it still means you get to blame Israel for any event anywhere. Well, I hadn't frankly heard very many people saying that Israel had anything to do with this, and frankly, I don't see how they could have.
No.
Money, you know, and then of course this is the token conspiracy that has to be thrown out if we're talking about conspiracies at all. The Illuminati did it. And how many times have you read this? The Illuminati, who have apparently been secretly running the world since the 18th century, usually in association with the globalists, the neocons, the Rothschild Zionists, etc., shot down the plane. For all sorts of reasons. The useful thing about the Illuminati is that despite being supposedly highly secretive, they leave clues about basically everywhere, all the time, from symbolism on U.S. banknotes to Rihanna. Do they mention Jay-Z?
They do not mention Jay-Z.
They don't mention Jay-Z. They don't mention Beyonce. They're the real Illuminists.
Right. Jay-Z is a time traveler, as we know now.
What was the thing about Jay-Z being a time traveler?
I saw this picture today of a photograph taken in 1938 in Harlem of this African-American man standing outside of a building, and I swear it looked exactly like Jay-Z.
Were people actually pointing that out also?
Yeah, they're saying that he's a Illuminati time traveler.
He's a Time Lord.
That makes sense to me. Hey, speaking of kind of outrageous claims, have you guys happened to see this little gem that I found?
Uh-oh.
This is about Ken Ham. Micah, have you read this story about his... Ken Ham, who is famously known for being the founder of the creationist organization, he is calling for the end of the space program because naturally all aliens are damned to hell.
Oh my gosh. Actually, we did link a story about that to Graylian Daily News today.
I mean, that seems perfectly logical to me.
So hold on. His position is now. Let me get this correct.
Because aliens could not possibly worship our Earth's God. So they are all damned to hell.
So in the space program,
why he says there's no need for us to search for extraterrestrial life since obviously they're all going to hell.
Okay.
So why I need a space program?
Man, I tell you.
Because that's the only thing that we could benefit from having a space program is to go find aliens.
You know, I've spoken with a number of holy men. As a matter of fact, is Father Jack Ashcraft still in the chat room? I know he was earlier. You know, I've spoken with a number of people of the cloth who have been and who have admitted to being very interested in this. You know, I've also heard, however you want to interpret this, you know, one, I guess we could call it, you know, more of a thought experiment than anything, but maybe I guess there are people who actually believe this, you know, well, if Jesus came to Earth, then he could go to other planets just as well. And he could, you know, hypothetically commune with the aliens just as easily, right? Just as easily as he could here. I prefer a little bit more of a universalist kind of approach to it. And I would say this, if there is a God that created life on Earth, that God presumably created life on other planets, and presumably that God is not going to damn to hell creation in another part of the galaxy because, I mean, he's showing some sort of a strange cosmic favoritism with life here on planet Earth.
Obviously.
Would he send the same Jesus to every world, or is this like the Green Lantern Corps?
Ah, good question.
Green Lantern Jesus.
I think... here's what I think happens. Okay, Jeremy, I think what happens is it was actually a clone. It was a savior clone that was sent to other planets, and using nanotechnology, I don't know. We could really... This starts sounding more like sci-fi than anything. Okay, when we come back... We might blow your mind. I always hope to try and do that. We've looked at a lot of silly media junk this first hour, kind of whetting your appetite a little bit for conspiracy. When we come back, I'm going to... my mind was blown, and here's why. You never hear on mainstream talk radio programs serious mention of subjects like conspiracies, like the mother of all conspiracies, first of all, JFK assassination, and then, of course, UFOs. Well, that's just crazy talk, right? You don't talk about that. Well, one guy did. You might find it as interesting as I did to hear what he had to say when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us.
It began as a routine cargo flight on November 17, 1986 between Tokyo and Paris. What followed was nothing short of uncanny. The crew aboard Japanese Airlines 1628 found themselves accompanied by something large and unexplainable.
Yeah, that's 1-2 again. We have confirmed there is a flight size of 2 around here, 1550 squawk, one primary return only.
Okay, where is he following us?
It looks like he is, yes.
Okay, stand by.
Do you have anybody to scramble up there, or do you want to do that?
Oh, we're going to talk to your liaison officer about that.
It's starting to concern Japan Airlines taking the 360 now.
Okay, we'll call the military desk on this.
Terauchi and his crew were notified, to which he replied that the object is quite big and that it appeared to be following them in formation.
Military radar advises they are picking up intermittent primary target behind you, in trail, I figure.
This and other mysteries of time and space await you on Enigmas. Every month, a special feature offered to Graylian X subscribers. Sign up today. Visit graylianreport.com/X. Go beyond the bunker.
This is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Fighting the good fight, as we always attempt to do here on this program. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, and you've locked in. It is the Grillion Report. We've got Caleb Hanks in studio tonight, and also special guest Jeremy London.
Hello.
He's
not the actor Jeremy London. We'll just let you know that immediately.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know.
He's famous, but he's not the one you're thinking of.
He's not the drone we're looking for.
Don't Google me.
Can I tell the people who you are?
Sure.
Tell them, Caleb.
He is the current Ronald McDonald. I'm just kidding.
It's true. He is the current Ronald. Well,
in all the commercials, he's Ronald McDonald. No, I'm just kidding. No, Jeremy was in this metal band called Sanctity that was pretty dang successful, and they went on tour with the likes of Megadeth and such.
That is right. I should have given you a proper introduction.
It's fine. It's fine. It's a separate part of my life.
We hang around a lot of rock stars here in the Grillion Bunker, and yes, Jeremy toured with Sanctity. You guys were on, let's see, what was the label again?
Roadrunner Records.
Roadrunner Records, that's right. I mean, yeah, it was a big thing there.
It was. Yeah, I mean, it was fun. I'm so young. I was so young at the time. I don't really remember all of it.
Yeah, well, you know how that goes, you know.
Yes, I do.
When you're in the moment.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, another guy who has actually asked us if he can be in studio with us in the future, and I do want to have him in the studio with us sometime. That's Justin Bilton, who is the current bassist for the band Three Doors Down.
I'd love to be here for that, too.
We might have to just do a rock and roll roundtable.
Yeah, right. People don't really know this about Justin, but he is very, very interested in all of the realms of the strange and unusual.
When back around St. Paddy's Day, in fact, he was in town and came out and visited with us. And it's so funny because I dressed up like I always do. I mean, I don't know if you know this. I love St. Paddy's Day. And I always dress up on that holiday.
Like a leprechaun.
Well, no, I mean, I put on a green. No, I don't do the green thing so much. I just
paint myself green and drag around a big pot of gold and scream at people like, this is what real leprechauns are.
Well, Caleb and I do always, you know, traditionally get together on St. Paddy's Day. But, you know, what I actually do know, I mean, I'll whip out my tweed coat, you know. And I end up looking more like a member of the cast of Darby O'Gill and the Little People rather than an actual little person. I mean, I'm not really a little guy. I'm, you know, pretty tall, fairly tall at least, you know.
Yeah, you're a tall guy.
5'11".
Yeah, you're tall.
So. You're a tall Garian.
Handsome too.
I'm not a, oh, thank you. Well, I'm no giant skeleton, but I'm a tall, thin man. Not a grinning
you're
man.
You're slender man.
I'm not a slender man.
He's
well,
slender
I am,
man.
I am technically a slender man.
I think that would be Caleb, actually.
Yeah, Caleb is a slender man. Well, you're pretty.
He's a little more slender than
I am. I'm relatively malnourished.
Caleb is pretty slender, isn't he? Yeah.
Eating Pringles over there.
Yeah. Munching on Pringles in here in the bunker.
Once you plop, you just can't stop.
Well, now, yeah, so last time we saw Justin Bilton was on St. Paddy's Day, and first thing he said to me was, he says, look at this guy standing over here looking like he's in a Doctor Who convention. Second thing he says is, I want to come on your show and tell you about the ghost experiences I've had while on the road with Three Doors Down. And I'm like, what? I said, you're just like one of these dudes who like attracts stuff. So he said, I want to come in there, have some drinks, and talk with you on your show about that. And I think people would love that. So yeah, we might have to get you in here, Jeremy.
Yeah, he's one of those people that can't wear watches, too. You know,
really?
Like, there's certain people that wear a watch and it kills the watch.
Oh, yeah.
Our mom is one of those people.
He does it with cell phones, too. Yeah. Like, he's been through like 25 cell phones because he'll get a brand new iPhone and like 2 days later it just completely dies.
I didn't know that about him, but you know, we did a whole thing. He is Magneto. Yes, it all comes back to magnetism. Remember what we said earlier?
Magneto's daughter is Scarlet Witch who can open up portals and travel through time. What the?
Oh, I want to meet that witch.
I want to meet that dad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'll tell you this though, man. We did a whole, a few weeks in a row, because Billy Clark, one of our longtime listeners, good buddy of mine, he's over in Europe, and he had said that he had woken up and had weird stuff happening where his watch would like stop, or it didn't just stop, it would actually lose 30 minutes exactly. Weird stuff like that was happening. And so I started getting a lot of emails from listeners who had things going on that were kind of similar. Who knows what's really happening? But no, I didn't know that about Justin, that he was one of those guys, the watch stoppers, you know. And I like to hear from people from time to time. If you're a watch stopper, we like to hear from you, whatever the case may be. If you've got Fortiana you'd like to share with us, info@grillionreport.com, you can send that email directly to me. Love to hear about that. Now, something else we were talking about, too, since we're about to get into some conspiracy talk here. You know, Jeremy, you were talking about kind of like what we were talking about in the last segment actually was Jay-Z. Jay-Z's yes. probably a time traveler. And the reason why is because, of course, he's a member of the Illuminati, and they have time traveling technology.
Yes.
But there is this kind of a fascinating connection with the hip-hop industry and the Illuminati and so many people, maybe not just the hip-hop industry, I mean entertainment in general, but you do hear a lot about it in the hip-hop industry. And specifically, I think, you know, you've got, you know, the artists. Well, actually, I guess it was it the Tupac album that was called Machiavelli, or he even used that as
he used that as kind of like an alter ego, and he always kind of said that he was going to come back from the dead, in which he kind of did in
as a hologram
form at Coachella.
Right.
Yeah, well, you know, Jeremy, you were talking about some of this stuff and some of these tie-ins and these connections. And
yeah, there's some weird stuff with some of the comedians like Cat Williams and Dave Chappelle. When Dave Chappelle left, he went to Africa.
I mean, he like literally almost went into hiding there for a while. Nobody knew where he was.
There's actually a really interesting video on behind the Actors Studio he did. I don't know if either one of you have seen that, but he actually talks about it all. And
really?
He was so young. He was really talking mostly about how during the Chappelle show, his father passed like right before he really started filming for that. And it really messed him up. But they keep talking about these people who are like forcing them out and are pressuring them into doing certain things. And they just keep using the vague terms like they. And they're talking about, you know, Hollywood execs. And Dave keeps talking about how, you know, they're telling him to do this. And finally, he just said, I can't do it anymore, and went to Africa. And now Cat Williams has gone completely crazy.
Really?
I mean,
he's saying the same sort of
stuff. He's calling the Illuminati out.
Oh, man.
Like, physically calling them out for destroying his life. Like, he's been, I think the last time I checked, he was arrested 36 times in 36 days and not charged with anything.
That's weird.
Wow, that's very
They're
hard.
Just trying to, like, mess with him. And then the next one was Martin Lawrence a few years ago, supposedly went crazy and running across the street with a gun, screaming, they're trying to kill me. And Dave Chappelle talks...
The ubiquitous they again.
Yes, the ubiquitous they. And Dave Chappelle talks about the same people that he was dealing with are the ones that were going after Martin Lawrence.
Like his Illuminati handlers or something?
His Illuminati handlers, basically.
Oh my gosh, you know, I don't know. I mean, I wonder... Okay, here's the question. If there are people in the entertainment industry who are completely bogus, I mean, it's all made up, and there's nothing to any of this, you know, well, then why do you see that erratic behavior? I mean, why do they allude to things like that? I have a hard time believing it's entirely for show. By the same token, I mean, I don't know that I would say that we have hard evidence that it is literally the Illuminist, you know, movement from, you know, the...
I mean, maybe they don't... What if it is an actual team of people that is messing with them? Maybe the only thing that they have, like, thought to call it is Illuminati.
I mean, I've wondered about the potential for COINTELPRO, I mean, you know, and government programs and things that seek to how do I want to put this, that would seek to essentially control people, which is something I think you definitely see with the UFO component just as well. Fascinating interview on the Paracast this past week where they interviewed James Carey, and, you know, former director of MUFON, and he basically tries to make the entire case that the entire Ghost Rocket thing and the early UFO thing in general, as a matter of fact, Roswell, he says, will be the subject of his next book, but he says that entire area, you know, in history where UFO phenomena became, you know, public knowledge, he says, sure, there may be something actually going on, but to my way of thinking, I kind of look at this and I can't help but think, you know, maybe this wasn't mostly deception. And so in this book that he's written, The Rosetta Deception, he makes the case that basically intelligence agencies, even sometimes outside the knowledge of, for instance, he calls him throughout the book like a... Uncle Joe, I guess, but he's talking about Joseph Stalin. And he says even outside the jurisdictions of world leaders that there were tests of essentially German rocket technology that had been captured by the Russians and the Americans that was going on over the neutral countries in Sweden. I think he basically makes the case that whatever was being seen over Sweden, which I wrote a book about called The Ghost Rockets. Well, it wasn't all about that, in fact, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But he essentially says that the ghost rockets that were seen in 1946 were probably Russian tests, but that the tests were kept so secret that it even fooled Stalin. And he wanted to know whose they were. And hence, history tells us that, well, the Russians didn't know what they were, but the Americans didn't either, and everybody was really interested in these things. Well, and I think actually one of our listeners emailed me and had pointed out my friend Chris O'Brien on the show had been a little amazed that I hadn't written in my book about the fact that the ghost rocket thing was even more widespread than just Europe, and rather specifically, you know, Sweden, Norway, Scandinavia. Specifically, I think Carrion talks about the fact that there were ghost rocket incidents that were occurring around the same time, I think in the Mediterranean. There were some sightings over France. In my book, and those who've read it know this, and I presume Chris O'Brien's read it too, but I think a lot of people still interpret it as being, you know, or presuming that it should be the definitive work on the ghost rockets from the 1940s. When in fact, actually, and I make this statement in the book, I start discussing the ghost rockets in the first chapter in relation to 46 because, well, this is when we first start seeing, again, by definition, unidentified flying objects that behave like rockets or missiles. But after the first chapter, which really gives only essentially an overview of what was going on there around Scandinavia, then I move on to the atomic age, and we start looking at reports of rocket-like UFOs through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and we bring it right up to the present. And really, I think that the key focus of the book and what got me interested in writing it was these reports from the NASA-maintained Aviation Safety and Reporting System databases that describe what I would liken being to more like drones, but they're rocket or missile-like in their behavior. Often they don't produce plumes, but they almost collide with jets in a number of instances, and it's really kind of creepy. That's what got me interested in wanting to write about it. And so I say in the book that I actually use the term ghost rocket because as this book deals with what are, by definition, UFOs, this term is already familiar to ufologists, and I say in the broad sense I would refer to these as all being, you know, essentially ghost rockets. And not to say that necessarily what began in 1947, or 46 rather, is the same thing that we still see today. I think probably more likely the ones we see today are like some kind of a strange drone technology, and in many instances that are unaccounted for. And of course, when you start having these things damn near colliding with, you know, passenger planes and things like that, that presents a real problem. TWA Flight 800 is discussed in that book just as well, because of course there were all these conspiracies about the idea that there was a missile seen in conjunction with that crash. But in the book, what I talk about is the fact that there were reports of missiles or rockets seen before and after TWA Flight 800 in the same vicinity. And so it really covers a phenomena that, whether or not it is a single phenomena or simply, you know, completely unrelated instances that involve rocket or missiles of unknown origin, that's what the book deals with, and it brings us all the way up to the present. You know, the purpose was not to try and focus solely on the ghost rockets of 1946, and so I think a lot of people have said, you know, you could have said a lot more about that. Well, there was a lot already that has been written, and I say that in the book just as well. We could spend all day talking about what's already been written, but I don't like rewriting what everybody else writes, you know? Klaus Vaughn, Anders Lilligen, I think we've also got, of course, Jerry Clark, and a number of other UFO writers who have dedicated a lot, and I actually list supplemental reading sources in the back of the book, because for people who are interested in that 46 phenomenon, there's a lot to be read. But I think the term that Chris O'Brien had used was, he said, I was slack-jawed, or I was, he was basically amazed that I didn't cover that in my book, and well, that's kind of the reason why. But I do know about it. And in fact, I think as recently as a couple of months ago on the Ghost Rockets Wikipedia page, it even mentions similar flaps that were occurring in France and the Mediterranean. So that is part of this, which is interesting to me because Carrion on the Paracast kind of is talking about how this was an intelligence operation. And that explains what the ghost rockets were. But they were seen in other parts of the world. And that certainly doesn't account for why certain things are still seen today. The idea that it was all just, well, essentially an operation that was intended to kind of confuse, a deception. I think you may be right about some of the stuff that was going on around that time, but it doesn't provide a full answer for all of it. And so that's the problem, is that in this field, what we always end up trying to do is, well, is there some sort of a grand dark conspiracy behind it all? Is there literally an Illuminati or some sort of an organization out there? You know, is it, did the Nazis outlive the Reich, and did they go underground? Did they use, you know, the acquisition of funds and all kinds of, you know, monetary you know, investments they may have made, and also gold and silver and actual literal loot that they maintained and dumped at the bottom of Alpine lakes and stuff and hid it out until the fall of Germany, or the fall of the Reich, rather. You know, and there are so many conspiracy theories. And I think that the point is to draw distinctions between the theories and the actual facts. When it comes to the Nazis and some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes during World War II, yeah, you're dang right. that there were some things going on, and that history shows that maybe there were a continuation of certain projects and certain operations and the like. Maybe we're seeing that happening in the world today. You know, are there, you know, centuries-old conspiracies, secret societies, things that are ongoing that people have been involved with that are actually controlling global affairs today? I couldn't tell you. But when we come back from this break, I do want to look at what one commentator had to say about a recent Rasmussen poll. It's like they do one of these every couple of months. This one was about American belief in conspiracy theories. Okay. News story, well, same sort of thing we've already talked about before, but we've got some interesting commentary about it when we come back on the Grayling Report. Mountains of Appalachia. It is the Grayling Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Caleb Hanks and Jeremy London in the studio. Tyler Pittman is feeling a little sick. He's got a bad head cold. We're hoping he'll be feeling better soon. Of course, you know, once we send him a little of the famous Earl Grayling green tea. Well, actually, it wouldn't be green tea if it's Earl Grayling, right? That'd have bergamot in it, but I digress. We'll get him feeling better either way. Now, this morning, I was amazed at something I heard. I'm so unused to hearing something like this on like a mainstream talk radio program. And I don't know how mainstream really we would say this is. I guess it still qualifies, but let me give you a little background. And set aside your political ideologies for a moment, because the man I'm about to mention, you know, some people may disagree with him.
Himmelstoss?
Yes, no. No, this gentleman is someone who, frankly, I have always enjoyed listening to him. I think of all the political commentators, this individual is probably less biased and has become even less so in recent weeks. I find that in terms of the American political paradigm, people both on the left and the right have tended to agree with the positions this man takes. His name is Glenn Beck. And the last thing that I ever expected to hear on a talk radio program, right, left, center, anything, that you can actually tune into on terrestrial radio stations and hear about, became a topic of discussion today. Now, in the past on this program, we have discussed a lot of different things in relation to conspiracy theories. I don't advocate conspiracy theories in general, but I think that there are, at times, elements to stories that become popular in the media that deserve greater attention. And one thing that's very unique about Glenn Beck is that, you know, he had his television program that was initially on. Well, the gentleman here, it must be warm in the studio. These guys are like sweating. That, or they're just concerned about what I'm about to say. No, it's all good. Everything's gonna be fine. Go ahead and you can button your shirt up again there, Jeremy. But you know, Glenn Beck had a television program on CNN, and then of course he went to Fox News. That would make all the sense in the world, because of course, you know, here we have the mouthpiece for conservatism, which really, I think that we have to draw a distinction between conservative political thought and the Republican Party. People who listen to his program a lot these days, and I don't have that much time to listen to the program frequently, but I'll tell you this, you know, I don't think that Glenn is any particular fan of the Republican Party, you know, or the Democrat Party. Again, I think he is a fan of people who do what is right, and in politics, we don't see a lot of that these days because people are beholden to ideologies. Just like on this program, when I try and tell you, listen, you know, you think, and don't say that I agree because a skeptic has said it or because a person from the believer paradigm has said it. Look at what the facts actually dictate and come to a decision on your own. In the Middle Theory program that McNonymous and I have done in the past, and which we'll return, on that podcast, the entire premise is, you know, again, let's keep ourselves from drifting off to the far right or to the far left. And it's not just a politics show. I mean, we say look at the middle ground on all things. And there you will typically find the truth because, again, you are not as beholden to an ideology. And I've heard talk hosts like Rush Limbaugh, for instance, say before that these people who are in the middle, They're just the ones who aren't, you know, brave enough to pick a side. And I think, no, as soon as you pick a side, again, what you're doing is you're allowing yourself to fall to an ideological extreme. You don't have to pick sides. You can remain in the center and you can say, look, whatever the truth is, allow it to be. And I'll stand here in the middle and I'll look right and left and I'll see what, you know, what needs to fall into the path of truth before me. Now, Glenn Beck is interesting as of late, especially because he moves from CNN to Fox News and then takes his enterprises completely into this GBTV thing. He's basically privatized. He's still syndicated as a national radio host. And I noticed that in the absence of having a network behind him that is of a particular political ideology, his presentation has, I think his fundamental message is still the same. Again, it doesn't matter if you agree or not. The point is I think that, you know, I see that his presentation has changed a little in the absence. And then again, this is a guy who is fascinating to a lot of people, not just because of whatever he says, also because of the amount of money that he makes, you know, that someone can privatize his industry and that he can essentially make more than Oprah, according to Forbes magazine. That's pretty incredible. So imagine my surprise. I'm driving down the road and I have switching between stations. I had talk radio on, I had music on, and I hear discussion about conspiracy theory, and it's the Glenn Beck program. I was very interested in what was being said. About the time I tuned in, they were talking about the Kennedy assassination, and I first have a little audio soundbite here where they're talking about the idea that, well, whether or not there was a lone gunman or if there was any kind of a conspiracy involving JFK. Now, of course, most in the mainstream, they don't want to say anything about that. They, come on, guys, the Warren Commission, that's it. I've questioned it before. This is what the conversation earlier had to say about it.
36% say Kennedy was the victim of a lone gunman. 37% say a larger conspiracy. One in four are convinced that the U.S. government knew in advance about September 11th.
Now, keep in mind, by the way, this is all discussion in relation to a Rasmussen poll that deals with conspiracies. Okay, and that's what they're talking about, these percentages.
4%. That's a tough one, though, the Kennedy assassination, because that's obviously the biggest one, the most popular one, the weirdest one, and maybe the one that's most plausible as far as something other than the official story being told, because there's a lot of questions. What do you believe it was just Lee Harvey, nothing else to it, done, over?
No, I think there was more to it.
I think so, too.
But I don't think there was more than one killer. I think it was Russians that were behind Lee Harvey Oswald.
Now, do you hear that? Now, this is what's interesting to me. You wait because all over the press probably in the next couple of days, you know, somebody's going to write, Glenn Beck peddles more conspiracy theories, says that, you know, that the Warren Commission was wrong. He says, I don't believe that there was more than one gun, but I think that the Russians were behind Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, there are people who would call that a conspiracy theory, but look, what are the facts? We know that Oswald went to Russia. You know, supposedly, he had even tried out, essentially, for the KGB. And what we also know is that Yuri Nosenko, okay, the ex-KGB spy who was interrogated for like a year straight by the FBI, he had said that Oswald had nothing to do with the KGB and that they'd rejected him, but failed a lie detector test, for what that's worth, on more than one occasion, okay? And then none of that, none of the discussion about Yuri Nosenko was even mentioned in the Warren Commission report. Why would you leave out something like that? Here's a guy who's saying, no. No, this guy had nothing to do with the Russians. And that really, I guess, in terms of the idea of there just being a lone crackpot who acted entirely of his own accord, as it is believed that Oswald did according to the official narrative, you know, that would be in keeping with that. And so that should be evidence that would steer one to believe that, well, okay, yes, maybe he really was just nuts. And maybe somehow, however strange it may seem, Oswald actually did this by himself. No, that was left out. Was it considered insignificant? And if so, why was the man basically, you know, I mean, he was interrogated for about a year straight and kept in captivity. Yuri Nosenko. Somebody thought that was significant to have kept him and interrogated him for that long. And the fact that he failed those polygraph tests. If it had just been one, we might say, okay, you know, come on, it was a polygraph test. It happened more than once. That's something that is interesting to me. And Glenn Beck essentially says right there, I think the Russians probably had something to do with it. And I heard that and I thought, okay, I kind of agree there. We totally agree. And actually, there are a lot of things he says that I agree with, you know. But I'll tell you this, what really got my attention is when the subject of Roswell, New Mexico and the UFO crash came up. And this is where it gets really interesting.
How can we
We've got
tie
true or false UFO with space aliens on board crashed near Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. 20% believe that.
Now, listen, this is what's funny is that you hear the guys, I love this one, you know, 20%, and they're kind of setting it up like, oh, this is the good one, man. UFOs, aliens, right?
Have you ever seen the
video?
Come on.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I've seen the autopsy video.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. It's true. It's pretty convincing.
So you say that?
Uh-huh.
And you try to make it sound like it's...
Like it's not convincing?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to because, wow, that thing is realistic.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now.
That's why 53% are either convinced it happened or are undecided. 53%.
Well, here's the thing.
Now, it sounds like they're having just a field day with it, but now Beck changes his tone right here. Check this out.
I do believe that our government does know, has evidence of something weird going on. I'm not saying that they have bodies of aliens or anything else.
No.
But what was it? Operation Blue Book or something where they tried to go in and they...
Kelly Blue Book? Is that what you're saying?
Now, I know that probably there are probably people out there who are up to speed on the whole UFO discussion. And they're probably cringing because, you know, again, he didn't get the name entirely right. But it gets better. You know, he actually asks his producers to help him pull up the actual information. Think about this and take it in the proper context. We have a nationally syndicated, I think at last check, it was the third most listened to talk radio program in America right now, according to numbers. And they're actually having a serious discussion about Project Blue Book that is not being dismissive. Initially, it sounds a bit like the producers there, Pat and Stu, were kind of laughing about it, as they often do on this program. And Beck, again, you know, he's not got Fox News behind him or CNN or anybody like that who essentially is going to allow him to say this or that. Not that he necessarily would have been allowed beforehand anyhow. And he actually starts having a serious discussion here. And this is where it starts getting interesting.
Trying to get the Blue Book
value of different automobiles.
There was a thing, something that was done in the 1960s where they were trying to talk to the pilots and everything in military about, you know, what have you seen? You know, weird stuff. And parts of that have come out, you know. And I think the cover-up, the unwillingness to actually... What was it?
Project Blue Book.
Right. Project Blue Book. And look it up. Tell me what it actually is. Because this is way off memory. But the problem is, again, the cover-up stuff. When you do secret, you know, projects like this, and you're like, okay, now don't say anything to anybody, that just creates conspiracy theories.
It does.
Right, but it's also, yeah, it there's does. Reasons for it sometimes, but you're right, it always creates that.
Now notice that the tone has become a lot more serious.
Yeah.
it's definitely kind of straightened up.
If you
and
don't,
what is the reason for that, Stu?
I mean, sometimes there's reasons to have national secrets, defense reasons.
Like what? You have the alien bodies in the trunk of your car?
Sometimes you have alien
trunk bodies. That would be one good reason.
Obviously. Car.
What does it say? What was it?
It was to determine two things. If UFOs were a threat to national security and to scientifically analyze UFO-related data. And it started in 1952, but in 1969 it was terminated.
See, if you just say it like Jeffy says it, it sounds
right,
like...
Right, but listen, what are the objectives. Listen to the objective. This is where this conspiracy stuff starts.
Right.
Name number one objective. Objective number one.
To determine if UFOs were a threat to national security.
No. No. To determine whether UFOs were extraterrestrial life and they were real.
Right. Well, but if they were, I would say they were a threat to national security. So yes,
correct.
Yeah.
But I mean, what I'm saying is just the way it's worded
right,
leads you to believe these things.
And this is why conspiracy theories largely are just nonsensical. You're basing it on things like that, the wording of something.
Oh, no, I know that.
Right.
I know that.
And this is why you can go down and find something that seems to be slightly out of step with what the way you think it should be in almost every single circumstance.
And I think the alien thing is the easiest one to believe, because I think as we begin to understand how vast the universe is, that we're not talking about our neighbors on Mars. I think everything in our solar system could be dead, and that's that, you know, no big deal.
Now, again, the important point to take from this is we're hearing a national talk show host like Glenn Beck, and he is actually, rather than doing what you always see, you know, the giggle factor, mysterious, he's kind of poking fun at that. a little himself. And furthermore, what we're also seeing is a serious discussion. I mean, yeah, they're having a little fun with it, yeah. But fundamentally, what Beck is saying right there is, look, you know, there was, before you just laugh about Roswell and alien bodies and alien autopsies and all this stuff, and how many people would you ever hear in the mainstream that would even attempt to make a distinction between aliens and something going on that, well, we don't have proof of aliens? And that's at the outset, even he may not have been the world's most authorized expert on Project Blue Book. He may not have made all the best points about Blue Book. He may not have had, like I have here, of course, you know, my copy of...
Right there.
Literally right here, you know, the top secret UFO findings revealed, Project Blue Book. Yeah, I actually got it right here. But he at least brings to the discussion, he says, look, wasn't there, there was a Project Blue Book, and that's not to say that there were aliens, but, you know, that the Air Force knew that there was something going on. And yes, it's easy for people probably to believe in the idea that they're aliens because, I mean, come on, what is the likelihood that there is not life out there, of course, who have not come to Jesus yet and have not been saved because they're all damned to hell because they aren't on Earth? But
I don't think enough people really, really think about the scope of our universe.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's an unfathomable thing to really wrap your head around, and one of the best representations that I saw recently was on the show Cosmos that Neil deGrasse Tyson is hosting right now. And I mean, it shows how big our observable universe is, how big we think the universe is outside of that. And I mean, a human brain literally cannot wrap its head around that.
Yeah.
And I mean, mathematically, dude, there would have to be other life out there.
Or there would have to be states of consciousness that maybe transcend life as we know it.
And as I like to tell the people after I give that whole big spiel, I don't think, personally, that we are being visited by biological aliens.
Really?
I don't.
I don't have proof before me that it happens, but
I'm not saying that's impossible. Well, I am not saying it's impossible, it's not, but yeah. I personally think that that it's something else. But my research has taken me in other avenues.
But, you know, I'd always wondered personally, because I listen to a lot of talk radio. I've worked in talk radio for years. You know, I've worked for clusters, and what that means is I've worked in situations where, you know, you've got conservative talk radio stations, and then, like, literally through the glass on the other side of the wall is, like, a progressive liberal talk station. And I would produce programs on both, and I would always hear the points and perspectives between all of them. You know, and then you'd have a music station down the hall. Music stations. You know, you'd walk down the hall and you'd hear country, and then you'd have rap next to that, and then you'd have, you know, like light rock or something.
It was by
like
virtue of this that you once witnessed with your own eyes Kenny Rogers.
I met Kenny Rogers. I met Jared from Subway, you know.
Whoa!
Yeah, I know, that's the big one, yeah.
Whoa!
it blows everybody's mind, more than UFOs. Yeah, I met Jared from Subway.
Is he skinny as he looks on television?
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he's skinnier than you are, Jeremy. No,
damn.
Actually, no, he's not. But I'll tell you this. You know, I think that was formative for me in my own experience in terms of this. You realize if you don't just sit and have your favorite radio station and listen to nothing but what that person says, and you are thrust into the midst of all of it, you begin to realize, oh, wow, this person, what they says doesn't match at all and even add up to anything, you know, akin to what this person is trying to say. Or you'll find that people on opposite extremes say the exact same thing and try and still act like they're fighting each other. You know, you begin to realize after a while that it's all BS, and that, right, well, you know, the more time that I spend, you know, standing in the middle, you know, and looking at what's going on either side of the glass, so to speak, the more I realize really we've got a lot in common, but we've got to separate all the ideological extremes from it. I've always wondered, you know, what guys like Alex Jones would say about UFOs. He never talks about it much on his program, but, you know, one night on Coast to Coast, he was actually asked about it by George Norrie. And Alex Jones actually makes some really good statements. And he says, you know, I've got people, you know, who keep me informed about the kind of things that I talk about on my program. And from time to time, the discussion about advanced aviation and, well, technologies that we would put on par with UFOs does come up from time to time. And Alex Jones essentially says, you know, my opinion is that this is less likely to be alien intelligence and more likely to be terrestrial technologies that somehow are kept clandestine. Now, again, that falls into the camp of conspiracy theory for most people, but really, that's pretty much in line with my feeling about a lot of this. Maybe not all of it. Some of it's so high strangeness, we don't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Skunk Works doesn't make what they do public, and we know that they are working on, you know,
or
aviation.
Or have in the past, yeah.
I mean, aviation. So, I mean, that right there's no conspiracy about that.
There's no question that there are advanced aerial technologies that the public does not know about. And we may be getting a little bit of it from time to time. I've talked about, for instance, the Federation of American Scientists and some of the, you know, the pages they have on their website. And their whole thing, by the way, is, you know, the FAS is essentially an organization that is, you know, that it is scientists who look at issues of relevance to national security. And so they are just as likely to look at things like, you know, they're going to be looking at intel and spying, you know, and they're going to be looking at the surveillance state and those kind of things, too. But they certainly have taken interest in mystery aircraft, and that is certainly something that is addressed. But again, you know, you might see a group like the Federation of American Scientists looking very conservatively at the idea of mystery aircraft, and they'd never say extraterrestrial. And really, although I don't know that I look at that as a likelihood, we should not and cannot rule that out. That is a possibility because, again, by virtue, you know, you were saying before the show, Jeremy, you know, if something becomes an identified flying object, I mean, it's no longer really a UFO, right? I mean,
right.
Well, how many of these, if we continue to call them UFOs, I mean, doesn't that mean we have no clue what the hell they are? Or we might have at least an idea, but that's still at best an educated guess. We have not proven, and that's why the ones that we call the unknowns are still unknown. We really do not know what they may be. It was incredibly interesting to hear, yet again, a talk radio host bringing what I think is a very sane perspective. Alex Jones has done that, and Glenn Beck sitting there. Again, it's obvious he's not an expert on UFOs, but still, you know, one of the most listened to talk radio hosts in America is sitting there saying, no, look, you know, seriously, there was a Project Blue Book back in the 60s, and they were obviously looking into something. It seems that the Air Force thought something weird was going on. That is saying more, even in the very simplest sense, that is saying more than most would ever be courageous enough to say. And I have to commend him for even taking time to say, look, you know, it's easy to see why people like assert conspiracies in relation to all this stuff, but maybe there's something going on. Don't right. you guys think so?
Well, it's kind of human nature to question things anyway.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't, you know, it's kind of irresponsible of you.
Yeah, if you sweep something under the rug because you're afraid somebody's going to call you on the carpet for
right.
it. You know, yeah, exactly. And again, it's funny because you see Pat and Stu at the outset, they're kind of laughing about it. And then Glenn goes, no, hold on. You know, I mean, obviously there's a little something going on here, at least a little something. Right. That's more than Philip Glass ever did, you know. That's more than Brian Dunning does. And that's more than most people. I mean, even Neil deGrasse Tyson, as brilliant as that man is, he doesn't want to even have a conversation about UFOs. And if you bring up Project Blue Book, he's certainly not going to talk about the high strangeness cases. Now, when we come back from this break, when it comes to the discussion of high strangeness cases, I do want to talk a little bit about high strangeness UFO cases and a personal favorite of mine. Although I should also point out that before we go to break, there was one final clip that I wanted to play here. I don't want to say that we're ahead of the curve in any way here on the Grayling Report, but just there was one other conspiracy that the guys touched on this morning. Does this sound familiar to anybody else?
Here's a conspiracy theory I've never heard of before.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you guys have. William Shakespeare is not really the author of the plays that are attributed to him.
Yeah,
does that sound familiar to anybody else? I don't know. Maybe just a little bit. Anyway, whether you buy it or not, we're happy to discuss the possibilities. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Jeremy London sits in with us tonight. Caleb Hanks, also behind the microphone, and the Grayling Report International Console over there. It's very large and lots of little glowing little tweedly-deedly dots and things. We'll be back right after this examining high strangeness UFOs on the Grayling Report. hidden tomes of ancient knowledge here on the Grayling Report. As a matter of fact, here in the studio, we are surrounded by UFO literature. We must be conspiracy theorists. Well, I don't know. I may not be. I may just be a UFO nut. I mean, look at what's over there on Jeremy's desk. You know, we got the Nazi connection. We got, Lost Secrets of the Gods. That was obviously written by crackpots.
The Naked Lunch, Micah's favorite book.
Scorzini.
Or whatever that's all about. Those are books, Nazi books my dad sent along.
Love you, Dad.
A nice portrait of Sasquatch that someone drew.
That is actually the famous forensic sketch.
There is a girl I see frequently that looks just like that Sasquatch picture.
I see
there.
Several that look like that, Caleb.
Stop talking about my sister. Like,
oh, yeah. Dick and Marilyn Carlson at the Eureka Springs UFO Conference. They brought me not only that image that was the face of the creature that the skeptic... Okay, the cop who saw it described, but that's also the creature that left the footprint, which they passed along to me, which I should show you, Jeremy, at some point. You'd find that cool. I've actually got that in the next room. What's that? What is the next room? What do we call that? It's no longer a studio. We repurposed it as a... is it the war room again? I digress. Jeremy was just interested when he got here to actually like come down below the ground and actually come into the bunker.
He just wanted to ride the elevator.
Was it amazing?
It was. It took me hours.
Well, now that's because the same sorts of problems that have caused hiccups during the broadcast tonight were also impeding our ability to get down here. What I love is when you're trying to get back up, you're trying to leave the bunker and the elevator breaks down. It's a very old system, a cable system, you know, traditional elevator, and sometimes we wonder if we're going to make it in or out alive.
There's strange smells as well.
There are indeed strange aromas down here. Odoriferous fumes.
If you guys read Gray Street, you'll know what that is.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yes. Gives a whole new meaning behind the brown mountain lights. Now, there's a book I have right here. You should read Gray Street, though, if you haven't, actually. In fact, Caleb's going to be doing some new Gray Street stuff before long, but... So I've got here in my hand a book. This is a 1968 tome titled UFOs Over the Americas by Jim and Coral Lorenzen. And they were the folks who were behind the APRO organization. And they actually describe what that is here in the book. And so I'd like to actually read from their words. The Aerial Phenomena Research Organization is a nonprofit scientific and educational organization incorporated under the laws of the state of Arizona. Now, its staff is made up of educators and scientists from every field. It was founded in 1952 by the authors and is the oldest existing unidentified flying object research organization in the world. You got to keep in mind, I guess that was actually founded one year before Project Blue Book. I think so. I may have my dates wrong, though. Now, its membership is made up of people of all professions, although a large percentage of the members are in technical and scientific fields. Now, that said, in this book, they talk a lot about a lot of incredible encounters. And I have to say that these days, you hear a lot about like big black triangles, these incredibly large aircraft and things. You don't hear a lot of reports of the traditional saucer shapes or something else that you heard a lot about during the 60s and 70s, these egg-shaped UFOs. And Richard Dolan and I, we haven't really disagreed about it, but Nick Redfern and I have agreed in saying that it seems like the traditional actual technological weird UFO reports that we used to hear about a lot, you don't hear about those as much anymore. And Richard Dolan on his radio program, you know, very politely disagreed with Nick and I and said, well, really, I think that we are still hearing about cases, but maybe it's the saturation or maybe it's the varieties of the phenomenon and the way that it manifests, you know, that have changed and everything. So he argues that we do have as many UFOs as we once did. I argue that you never see books that catalog a phenomena and as much of it as like what you see in books like UFOs Over the Americas that the Lorenzens had written. And again, now, before I get to this case, I mentioned triangles and things like this. And Jeremy, I did want to see if you would be willing to talk about something that we were discussing before the show that you actually observed a few years ago over the airport. Is it cool to talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Jeremy had an incredible encounter. And so before I read this, I mean, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what you saw.
Yeah, I was turning on to the Highway 26 coming from Brevard, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And pulled onto the interstate. And I get about half a mile down, and traffic just stops.
Mm-hmm.
Super weird. I don't really know what's going on. People start getting out of their cars. And this is in 2001. If anyone else out there saw the same thing, please contact me. But, yeah, I look up in the sky, coming across the Asheville Airport runway, and there is a huge slow-moving craft of some sort crossing over the hill. And if you're familiar with the area, you know what hill I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It was kind of dusk. I mean, I could tell it had huge, I guess, jetpacks or propulsion. Some sort of propulsion system was coming out of the butt end of the ship, mm-hmm. and it was black. And it was triangle-shaped or square-shaped. I couldn't really tell from the back end. It was squared off.
About how big would you say it was?
Massive. Size of a football field.
But now you said also that apparently people were stopping their cars and looking at this
thing. Yes, both sides of the highway was stopped, and everyone was looking at this thing. And what's funny about it is I didn't even remember it happened until the next day.
Really?
It's the strangest thing. I remember I was going to see my girlfriend at the time, and I got there, and I didn't even think about it until the next day.
You know, you hear about that a lot, though, where people are like, wait a minute, what did I see last night? Did I have, you know... the reason that happens, God knows. A lot of people will use that to poo-poo, you know, people's claims of things that they've seen. Whereas to the contrary, I feel like sometimes something is so strange that it takes the mind a little while to kind of catch up to the possibility. And, you know, it's like, God, you know, I saw something last night. And then you start thinking about it. I didn't think too much about it at the time. You know, are there reasons why? Maybe so. Maybe it's psychological. Who knows? But it's interesting because you hear a lot of those kind of stories these days. What you're about to hear, you don't hear as much of. And this is directly from the APRO files. Now, this occurred back in, I believe, 1959. And the story goes that there was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Uribe. And I believe that the encounter here took place in Chile. It says that on August 9th of 1959, Mr. and Mrs. Uribe left the camp where they lived to go to Sombrero, the main camp of the installation, to pick up some supplies. Now, they were returning home at about 7:30 p.m. I believe their daughter was with them just as well. And it says they were returning home when their pickup truck that they were driving stalled unexpectedly. Now, Mr. Uribe, on investigation, found that he was just out of fuel. The particular type of truck that he was driving was powered by butane gas, and he realized that he'd have to wait for another vehicle to come along and give them a lift back to camp. So he and Mrs. Uribe settled back and waited. Now, an 11-year-old girl employed by... Okay, it wasn't their daughter. It was a girl who was employed by them. Was along, and she was in the vehicle with them. Now, Uribe was nervously pushing and pulling the button that controlled the car's lights, turning them off and on. So keep that in mind. That may or may not be significant, but, I mean, that might... One could interpret it that, you know, pulling and pushing the light and turning on the lights like that. Keeping in mind, this is 1959, and we don't have a lot of push-pull systems in old cars, but if you've driven an old car, you know what I'm talking about. And it was essentially flashing the headlights off and on. And it very well may have been that he was actually doing this to flag a vehicle because they were going to have somebody give them a lift. He was out of fuel. Now, at approximately 7:54 p.m., the little girl was the first to spot a light to the right and ahead of them. And it said, or she said, "I see a light. Somebody's coming." So the trio watched, thinking that it was another vehicle and that their ride home was quickly approaching. Now, shortly, however, they realized that the light couldn't have been from a car. It was swinging with pendulum-like motion, and it came closer to the ground. Now, Uribe described the light as bright blue. Again, blue is not a color that, you know, typically you're going to see on most aircraft, but at this time it may not have been clear to them that they were looking at an aircraft. They said that it looked bright blue like an arc welding light and appeared to scintillate like a jewel. It's an interesting description. Seconds after deciding the light did not emanate from a car, Uribe speculated that it might have been a lantern hanging on the saddle of a horse. And then, having to discard that idea, he decided it might be from a helicopter. Something's humorous to me about the idea of the lantern hanging on the front of a horse. But what's interesting about that is that, you know, people are often very creative in their descriptions of what they think that they're seeing, because as they're seeing something that appears strange to them, they're working through it in their mind going, okay, can't be this, couldn't be that, maybe it's this. You know, in other words, in a lot of these cases, and this one goes back to 1959 yet again, but it's interesting that people aren't going, oh, look, it's a flying saucer. No, they're going through everything else in their mind trying to determine, okay, no, maybe it's this. No, maybe it's that. No, maybe it's this. So the latter explanation, the helicopter, was discarded shortly too because there was no sound coming from the light as it got closer to them. Now, the shape behind it eventually became apparent to the Uribes and the girl with him. It appeared to be a large metallic egg standing on end with two shafts of white light projecting downward from the bottom and angled slightly outward. These lights gave the appearance of spotlights and illuminated circular patches on the ground below. From the top of the egg shape protruded, and this is kind of weird, a series of metallic pieces which resembled an extended chain ending in a rose-colored megaphone-shaped device which rotated or swept around continuously. Now, this thing's flying through the air, but there's no sign of wings. There are illuminations, no sound being produced by it either, but this megaphone-looking thing sweeping in all directions on top of an extended chain. I mean, it's bizarre. Now, when the configuration and color of the object was obvious, at this point, Mr. Uribe became upset. He cautioned the girl to keep quiet and continue watching and to memorize everything. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It was Mrs. Uribe that became upset, and hence her husband told her, just watch, memorize everything that's happening. The little girl was crying as well, but they tried to tell her, watch the object with us, trying to remember everything that's happening. They realized whatever they were seeing was something significant. When the object reached a distance which Mr. Uribe felt uncomfortably close, he got out of the truck. At the instant that he closed the truck door, the object moved quickly through an arc of 30 degrees, putting itself behind the truck and to its right, and thus in a position to observe Uribe, who had been out of sight of the object when he got out of the truck. So in other words, he jumps out of the truck and this thing zooms around and positions itself very suddenly. I mean, it's so suddenly it really disturbed him the way that this thing moved, because it had been approaching rather slowly at first. He gets out of the car, slams the door, and the thing goes zoom and comes around and positions itself so that it can watch him. Well, this made him fairly uncomfortable. And so at this point, and he described that it made a whishing sound at this point when it moved, something that he described as going like shoo, just like that. The quick movement startled Uribe, who walked to the back of the truck. The object then resumed its original position exactly opposite of the truck and began to move closer to the truck. Thoroughly disturbed at what he was seeing this thing do, Uribe reached into the back of the pickup truck and grabbed his rifle. And just, he says, as he raised the weapon to his shoulder, the object immediately began to recede. In other words, this thing was apparently aware of the fact, whatever control it was under, that this man was arming himself with a weapon and raising it to his shoulder to point it at the object, and it begins to recede. It was completely out of sight within seconds. So the whole thing transpired in a period of only about 6 minutes. It had been 7:54 when the light was first sighted, and then right after it disappeared at 8 p.m., a truck eventually came along. The driver took the Uribes back to camp, and all was over. But get this, he gets back and he tells a few of the people at the camp what had happened, and they all tell him, you know, yeah, we have seen things just like that, too. And a party was even sent out to search for any evidence. None was found. But other people had said, yeah, there's been something around here that we've seen that looks an awful lot like that, too. Now, what the hell was that thing?
Mork from Ork.
It was a big egg. Yeah, exactly. Somebody, there was a little man in there. Now, the size of the object was about, you know, again, I think about 5 feet wide in diameter at the center of what would have been the egg. So we're not talking about like a huge craft that could have had a bunch of little men in it. I mean, presumably this would have fit, and maybe uncomfortably, one human.
It was a drone.
Maybe so. Again, was it something that was remotely controlled? That would be my guess. But again, what the hell kind of technology? Wingless technology, moving completely silently through the air, only large enough to house a single individual, and hence perhaps remote controlled. Who had that in 1959? I mean, that just boggles my mind. Now, again, let's look at what, you know, Glenn Beck had said earlier. Okay, well, I don't know if we're dealing with aliens. It's easy to see why people would say that, though, when you look at a case like this. Because it's like, who the hell on earth would have had that technology?
Maybe it was Russia.
Well, again, you know, you'd been talking about that earlier. You know, well, okay, if we don't have it, could somebody else have something like this? James Carrion, you know.
Right.
His whole theory is, okay, what if the Russians were using technology that we didn't know about and that Joseph Stalin didn't even know about, and this is what the ghost rockets were? But again, the ghost rockets, to me, were pretty obviously some sort of rockets, and I even said this in my book, in the chapter I devoted to the actual 46 phenomenon. These things were obviously some sort of rockets that were being tested, although there have been a few instances where there have been rocket-like UFOs reported that didn't behave as much like rockets and behave more like something else.
But the first computer chip wasn't invented until 68.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, something that would have, you know, enabled a remote control kind of... Well, you know, actually, there were radio-controlled drones as far back, I think, as the 1930s, but that was a much more primitive technology. And again, those things, hey, they have wings, you
know? And Nikola Tesla did very similar things with wireless communication. So.
See, that's another interesting thing, is that Tesla... I don't remember where this... If anybody in the listening audience knows anything about this and can help me out, I would love to get the exact quote. Caleb, I don't know, maybe you'll remember this, because I know that you're a Tesla nut, but... I seem to remember that shortly before his death, Tesla had said, in speculating about, you know, what kind of technology would be best fitted for an electric kind of a aircraft, I seem to recall him saying that a disc shape, a cylinder, or something circular would probably be the most whatever formidable form that an actual electric aircraft or spacecraft even might take.
Well, as we know from Back to the Future 3, when Marty McFly throws the pie tin, you know,
yeah,
it's a perfect design. It's a perfect.
Well,
design.
Actually, okay, good point. I mean, yeah, it wouldn't take a genius like Tesla to take a pie pan, turn it upside down, and throw it like a frisbee,
it
and go
its own lift, really,
and go wow, yeah, this object flies, and it's basically the perfect aerodynamic shape. Good point. You know, I mean,
speaking of some Tesla stuff, though. Not only is, I think it's a team of Russian scientists are trying to rebuild the Tesla tower that he supposedly, or in some people's minds, proved that you can power things wirelessly. But I was talking to a friend of mine last night, Micah, while we were out with some friends, and he had recently been out to Los Angeles and met a guy who is working for a company that is about to apparently break through, and their product is going to be wireless power, charging pretty much anything. And if this comes to fruition, like this guy was telling my friend Evan, that is a game changer.
Let's hope he's got good bodyguards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hope he's got lots of security. He's going to need it. You know, again, just take a look at the film. And I hate to even have to bring that up. I don't mean to be a conspiracy theorist. But, I mean, the truth of the matter is you know, you watch these what was the documentary? Who Killed the Electric Car?
Yeah.
When you've got something that so much more easily and affordably offers people, you know, the convenience of transportation, energy, communication, you know, well, unfortunately, there are, I do believe, are people out there who probably seek to control that because of the monetary interest involved. And also, of course, when you've got energy, if it has to do with energy, you remember the old idea of the Tesla death ray? Of course, the temptation of utilizing it for weaponized purposes is always too great. That's going to have to be the final word for this week's edition of the Grayling Report. Jeremy London, thank you for sitting in with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Hope you'll come back sometime. Caleb Hanks, as always, a fine job. Well done.
Yeah!
Aside from a few Hadals chewing on wires and things, it's been another eventful evening. And on behalf of all of us tonight, we enjoy having you here and appreciate your listenership. Matthew Oakley, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Chris Hayes, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, we all bid you adieu. I'm the mouth of the South. It has been the Grayling Report yet again, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to The Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Grayling Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylingreport.com.